is Friday, July 17, 2009, and I'm in the home of the fabulous drum teacher and percussion instructor, Bob Scarlett of Grass Valley, California. Bob, when I met you the first time 2 years ago on my annual West Coast trek to Arcata for the Afro-Cuban drum dance and song camp, you treated me like I was a visiting expert. So it was shocking to me the other day when I took your class and how much I had to learn from you. I'm so honored to know you and soak up the great stuff that you demonstrate, and I wanted to publicly compliment you here on your teaching prowess and fine grasp of how drum rhythms can be taught and learned. So let me start with a couple of questions, you know, and we'll just have conduct a little interview here.
Sure.
Anything you want to share about your personal history? You know, just who you are, you know, where you grew up or something like that.
Well, I grew up in California. I was raised in a place called Westwood, California, up north.
Okay.
Near Lake Almanor, that area. Then I went to high school in Sacramento.
Okay.
And then after high school, I traveled around the world, Europe and Middle East, and that's where I really got into Middle Eastern music at that point. That's when I really kind of started focusing on Middle Eastern music.
Okay. Yeah. And how old were you then?
I was in my, mid-20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
A young whippersnapper.
You got it.
Taking on the world.
Yeah. Full of ego.
Like you went out there thinking you were going to be good.
Yeah. I really wasn't intending to...
To be a drummer.
To be a drummer, but it just worked out that way because when I went to Middle East, I started... exposed to really amazing drummers, and so I kind of got a really good introduction. That's kind of how I really started drumming, is through Middle Eastern music.
Okay.
And then I came back here and I further developed it, and I ended up with a girlfriend who was a belly dancer, and so when you have a girlfriend that's a belly dancer and you're a drummer,
it's a good match.
You will drum for her.
that's awesome.
That's the end of the relationship, right?
It's like, yeah.
Okay. So I further developed it. I came across some really cool teachers here, but then I started getting very interested. Well, I've always been interested in African music.
Okay.
And I had a roommate. When I was in the army, I was stationed in Germany, and I had a roommate who was a Haitian drum master.
Wow. And he was Haitian?
No. He was from New York.
Okay.
And he and I were roommates for 2 years, and so, but we didn't have any drums, so we banged on plastic buckets.
Nice.
With
sticks or just hands or
both.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, so we weren't that big of a hit on the bass there. But we kind of made a lot of noise, and
yeah,
so we kind of got down. So we had to go other places to work on it. But he was really into teaching me some of the basic Haitian rhythms, and it was really, really great time. So, and then I got an overseas discharge in Germany, and I went traveling around all over Europe, and that's when I went to the Middle East, and that's when I started getting really interested in Middle Eastern music.
Yeah, all right.
Then I kind of worked on that for a while. I had some fabulous teachers.
Yeah.
And then like I said, when I got back here, I had a girlfriend, and then I really developed. And she was a fabulous Middle Eastern musician herself, and so she and I developed our skills together, more or less. And so we had various Middle Eastern drum and dance troupes, and so we played Balkan Bulgarian music. So we developed a Balkan Bulgarian band with just some people that we met.
Yeah.
And so we had a Balkan Bulgarian band for 7 years. So that was fun. So we got to work with a lot of odd rhythms, and that Middle Eastern music and Near Eastern music is really appealing to me. I really loved it, learned to love it. And so I learned how to play the kaval and tapan and
various, Kash Lamar.
Huh?
Kash Lamar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Various Middle Eastern instruments.
Yeah.
The one instrument I really liked was the inblown flute, and so I really developed that skill.
Like it's just a, flute that's just a cut off flat on the end, and then you have to like use your mouth perfectly.
It's like a shakuhachi, but it's more off to the side. Shakuhachi is they direct the instrument below their chin kind of thing.
Yes,
this is off to the side more.
Yeah, is there one called a nai?
It's called
Is there one called a nai?
Yeah. That's more of a Turkish.
Okay.
Instrument.
And yours were more
Bulgarian.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And so anyway, I got into that. And so that lasted for about 7 years, that band, and then we kind of evolved. And by that time, I started. You know, at that same time, I was learning other. You know, drumming became, you know, a real passion for me, and so I started really getting into it. But actually, when I really became interested in drumming was many years before I went into the military, because I heard some African, you know, records, drum vinyl records in those days. Bob Tunde was Drums of Passion. So when I got the Drums of Passion record, I wore it out.
Okay, so that's a good story in itself.
And that's when my quest began, you know. But in those days, you couldn't even buy congas in the store. You had to special order them.
So interesting.
There were some stores I go into and they go, conga? What's a conga?
Yeah.
Well, that's a Latin drum, man.
Is it like a bongo?
Yeah, right. Right.
What is that?
Yeah, bongo. Yeah. No, it's like you had to special order drums. I mean, you couldn't buy them just in any music store. You know?
Uh-huh.
So,
when was that? Like date wise?
This was back in. I would say in the 60s.
Okay, not the 1800s. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, right. Close. 63, 64.
Yeah, 1863. Yeah.
but Baba Tunde, and I listened to his record, and it was like it just blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, what's really interesting, I met Baba Tunde when he was still, you know,
whippersnapper.
Yeah, well, not a whippersnapper, but he came up here and did a couple of workshops, and I sponsored him.
Yeah.
So he and I got to talk, you know. And,
yeah.
And I shared with him, it's like, you know, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be in this whole. Probably, I don't know.
Yeah.
You can't tell, but I told him that, you know, he really stimulated my interest in drumming, you know.
How did he take that? Was he like
really, really flattered and honored, you know?
Yeah.
He was like, you know.
He was genuinely flattered.
Oh, yeah. Well, Baba Tunde is just an extraordinary human being anyway. And
cool.
I mean, he has so much presence. Unfortunately, he's onto the other realm.
The other side, yeah.
But, yeah. Baba Tunde, in fact, he was one that jump-started the whole drum craze in this country, really,
if
you think about it.
Okay.
I mean, he's the man that really started this whole thing, because he started coming out with these records in the 60s. Drums of Passion being one of them, that was one of his biggest hits. And it became a big hit in this country. People were just, prior to that time, I don't think people were really, American people were ever exposed to that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of misperceptions around what drumming was about, you know.
Yeah.
That it was just random people beating on skins or whatever, right? Without any reason.
No direction.
Yeah.
They didn't really know what they were doing.
Right.
Yet.
And so he's the one that really, really, he was the true ambassador for the African music tradition. So he brought it to this country, and so he turned a lot of people on, including myself. Yeah, so that was really cool.
So you actually learned some stuff from him. You had
I
you have one-on-one lessons with him, like also, or just
not really? I sponsored him up here a couple times, and I sponsored. By that time, I was teaching. I was well into my teaching career.
Okay.
And so I was able to muster up a student body for him.
Okay.
It's pretty sizable. And plus, his name brought a lot of people in too. So
yeah.
I used to create pretty huge classes for him to come up, and then he would like do a workshop during the day, and then in the evening he'd get together with his band, and do an evening performance.
Uh-huh.
So he did that up here you know, 3 or 4 times. And yes. Yeah. Really.
When you say up here.
I would say Grass Valley, Nevada City.
Really? It was actually here?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that's funny. He was just, his diabetes was starting to really get the best of him at that point. I know the first workshop, he was pretty frail.
Yeah.
Second one, I noticed he didn't have any fingers, or a lot of his fingers were gone.
So, wow.
So he, you know, the guy just, he's still, the way he taught, he had well, some of his band members demonstrate, you know, he didn't demonstrate, he just talked about the whole tradition, you know, the sacred tradition of drumming and their music in Africa.
Okay.
So he was like a superb ambassador for his culture.
Yeah. I mean, now, of course, Africa is like not just like one place.
And everybody
all does the same thing. So, what kind of section of Africa
he's a West African, pretty much. You know,
like Senegalese.
But he represented. He had such a broad perspective of African music. He represented all of Africa.
Pretty much all the
pretty
other
well,
ones.
Yeah. Because he talked and described about different cultures in Africa and a lot about what their traditions were. And so, he was well educated. In fact, he came here as a student.
Okay.
He came here as a student.
No kidding.
Yeah. He was like, he was going to be came here as a foreign student. I can't remember, I think some college in New York, I can't remember totally.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he started, you know, doing his music and it just spread from there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he became really popular. So. Anyway, he's the man who jump-started me. And he's the one that really jump-started me and a lot of other people.
Uh-huh.
It's like when I heard that record, it was like, oh my God, what is this? This is like nothing I've ever heard before. And it just lit me up.
Yeah.
All parts of me just lit up with that music, you know.
Awesome.
So anyway, I have to point out that he's really the guy who really initially stimulated my interest in it.
Right. And, you know, of course, when I do these things, one of the questions I always ask is, who was probably one of your main inspirations? So this, you know, your answer kind of included that. So
yep.
We'll kind of skip that one then. We
sure
know now. But are there any other inspirations that, you know, you had along the way that kind of made you who you are?
Oh, well, my Congolese brothers, you know, Bitingo, Masamba, and you know, Titos, and, you know, you name it. And people who are from the Bay Area who are into drumming, those names are really familiar.
They would know who are there. Yeah. I don't. Yeah.
Right. So I hung with them for, it's been like almost 30 years I've been hanging with them. They started, my friend Kai Sorland started, jump-started their camp philosophy.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the Congolese were the first, really, to really create a camp atmosphere where they bring their whole culture into one camp. Not now, it's, you know, West, everybody does it now, the Brazilians, the West Africans, but the Congolese were sort of the leaders in that, and Kai Sorling was the one that kind of put it all together.
Okay.
And helped them put it together.
Yeah.
And so shortly after that happened, I started hanging out with them. And so they are probably my main inspiration.
Yeah.
Because they really taught, gave me a really great foundation on at least the Congolese tradition and other traditions too.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of these masters are.
Now, what type of drums were you playing on? Were they congas or were they
the Congolese have a drum called an ngoma.
Okay.
It's a big, tall drum, and they play they play standing up.
Okay.
Their legs. And anyway, I can get this one.
Okay.
Can you edit this stuff out? So anyway, the Congolese were my main teachers, my main inspiration. They kind of really grounded me, and you know, they took me by my hand and just worked me through. They worked the hell out of me. it was a fairly hard school.
Yeah.
And they're wonderful people and they're great teachers and we had to go through our changes together.
Yeah.
And now, are especially these, then.
Were the drums in Goma? Were you actually playing on?
Yeah, yeah. But I played mostly conga, which it was acceptable to me. Of course, not everybody goes to camp can't have a, don't have an Goma. It was a very specialized instrument, so not many people have them.
I see. Yeah.
So okay. I played both. I played in Goma, but for years I didn't have one. I have one now.
Yeah.
I just decided I'm going to start doing presentations with the Goma, so I figured I'd get one.
Yeah.
But mostly I was working with congas, but the, you know, the principles are still the same.
Okay.
I mean, the drum is completely different. The sound is totally different. And it's not. Yeah. It doesn't relate to because their music is based on the sound that the Goma produces.
Gotcha. It's a lower tone, right?
Yeah.
Much
well,
lower.
It's got a big deep throaty sound, and refer to it as the sound of Central Africa, you know, the jungle.
Yeah.
Jungle. Whereas like the djembe is like a desert instrument, you know, so it's got the high cracky sound.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah,
but,
that makes sense.
But they refer to the Ngoma as a jungle instrument. It's got that deep throaty grounded. It's a very cool sound.
Uh-huh.
And so they've developed, you know, the whole musical drum history of the conga is built around that drum.
Yeah.
Just like.
I had heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just like any tribe in Africa or any indigenous group in Africa, they base their whole music on their instrumentations.
Mm-hmm.
Because they create, you know, sounds. And there's some tribes that because the way their language is modulated, they can do that on the drum. So literally they talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I've been kind of experimenting with that over the years myself with the English language. That's a whole new story. But just trying to see if I can, any way that I can incorporate the English language and articulate the English language directly right on the drum. So I have a little thing that I've been working with on that.
Well, you want to demonstrate?
Ouch. Right. Well, you caught me flat-footed here.
That's all right. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah. One of those. For instance, my name, Robert Kennedy Scarlett.
Okay.
Robert Kennedy Scarlett. Right.
So oh yeah.
Robert Kennedy Scarlett. Yeah. So, and I had a little exercise with my Robert Kennedy Scarlett. So I'd have a little exercise with my students where I had them pronounce their name on the drum.
Okay.
And then cycle it.
Oh, and keep it going.
Right.
Yes. Good
and
idea.
So
Robert Kennedy. Yeah.
Yeah. So nice. So that's my name.
Uh-huh.
Right. So anyway, I've taken steps further than that.
Well,
that's the basic foundation of it, right? So each person in my class would have their own rhythm based on their name, right?
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool, yeah. Let's hear your rhythm. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So everybody in my class had a rhythm that was theirs, that belonged to them, right?
And what was the rhythm that we played, like, earlier? We're going to use it somewhere in this, you know, like at the beginning or end or both. That was
a bocongo.
Bocongo.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so the way it's really played is much, much faster than the way we played it. But it's a really, really intense rhythm. It's
Congolese. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's very, very, very intense.
So Congolese. We did two drums. And like how many parts would they have? When they play that, would they just have two drums, or would they have, like, you know?
Well, for that rhythm, they'd have three.
They'd have three.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just three drums, or three rhythms, and more than one person on each part. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. They have three parts. Well, they had other parts too. They had a lead part, which is normally played on a deep, deep, low drum.
The biggest drum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they're the ones that play the dance, but they also threw in other things that I never got. There's every time I go to a conga camp, it's hard to get all of it, right?
Sure. So I know what you mean there. Yeah. Yeah.
I know you do.
Yeah. Really well.
Yeah. So yeah. So anyway, I became sort of so my function really became what I started doing 20 years ago. Well, when I started, well, 30 years ago, when I started with them, so I transcribed everything. I recorded everything and transcribed everything. So it was kind of my passion to do that.
You were methodical.
Oh, yeah. So I went to a drum camp, not just Congolese, but I went to West African, Brazilian, I felt a real responsibility to archive this stuff, you know.
Okay.
So I spent lots of time. When other people were partying around at camp, I would be, you know, hard at work transcribing for hours. I mean, I transcribed.
Yeah.
Mostly, you know, and over a period of time, I became more and more skilled at it.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, it was real difficult. I had to, like, horse through everything, you know. It took long hours, and so it was quite tiring. But anyway, I got probably 30 years of material. Archived. I don't know what I could do with that.
How do you archive it?
Yeah, Bob? I could teach a new rhythm every day for, you know,
for a year.
But that's teaching rhythms has really evolved. The way I teach now is I don't teach rhythms. I do teach rhythms, but I have another focus that, you know, I work with.
Uh-huh.
Teaching, I have hearing exercise, and so you can, you know, and rhythm games and stuff like that, and hearing exercise where people develop their time, the sense of time.
Right.
So anyway, most of my focus now in teaching is doing that.
Yeah.
And also talking about what rhythm's about and what the implications of notes and time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
African rhythms they're not random, you know. They're thousands of years old, and so they, each note that's placed in a song is very, very specific for a very specific reason and purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so my whole thing right now is trying to get a feel what does it feel like, or when you place notes together, groups of notes, what does that feel like, what kind of energy does that invoke. So all these songs are designed to evoke energy, specific energy.
Right.
That's why it's really profound stuff. It's not, you know, it's not like I said, these songs have been worked on and have been worked over for maybe thousands of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so none of this is random. It's well thought out.
Yeah, it's evolved.
By master drummers who, you know, over the years, and it's an integral part of their culture. It represents who they are. It's their music.
Yeah.
No.
Now this leads me, it's probably a good segue to the next question, you know, that I was going to ask you, which is, you know, both Bob and I are philosophy majors in the University of Earth, and we could go on and on for hours about, like, you know, what's our reason for being here on the earth, and what's good about our society, what's bad about it, you know, what should we be doing to make it a better one, you know, it's philosophy, right? And so my question is, how do you incorporate your philosophies into your drum teaching?
Everywhere.
Okay, well, we'll move to the next question.
Yeah. Is there anything else you didn't know?
Yeah. He went on and on about history, but now when he gets to philosophy, he clams up.
My philosophy around drumming, drumming, like any discipline, is a metaphor for life. It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
I mean, I really learn mostly about myself, but I also learn, especially my relationships to people, to groups of people. So I've been teaching, you know, for 20 years, and I've encountered many, many, many groups of people. So I've really learned a lot. So for me, it's a learning process, you know, and seeing myself, you know, just who is Bob Scarlett in the context of random people who come together and have fun with this medium. But as I said to you before, I'm really clear that, and I got clear with this really early on, that what I do is not about drumming at all. It's not about drumming. Because, you know, it could be any groups. There are many creative groups that people can get to, dancing, singing. But what I've discovered is that people want to come together in a group and work together and contribute and make a difference and experience their creative side. Experience creativity with other people, you know, and be vulnerable. So my definition of true power is the willingness and ability to be vulnerable. So this is one time where that's power, man. That's true power. Because that's internal. Because when you see somebody who's vulnerable, what do you want to do? You want to protect him. Your heart goes out. So if I'm vulnerable with you, you become vulnerable with me. And we've got really profound communications happening there. So what I do is I'm just a person who creates a space for people to come together to be vulnerable with each other.
Okay.
And to be creative, you know, it's not, like I said, it's not about drumming. It could be anything.
Right.
So people want to gather together to see and to be seen.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To know that they exist, to know that who they are makes a difference.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, as a teacher myself, you know, like when I'm in the classroom, I try to do the same thing. Like, I would say that, yeah, I'm a science teacher, but it's more than that. It's so much more that it's almost silly to say science.
Yeah.
I like to just say I'm a teacher.
Yes.
And would you say the same thing? I'm not a drum teacher, I'm just a teacher.
Right.
Yeah.
And because of your function, you bring people together. In this case, you bring kids together, which is really profound, because you're in the formative years with kids who are just learning who they are, and so you're the one kind of, and they look to you as an example, right?
Mm-hmm.
They look at David Crowder. It's like, wow, he's my teacher. You know, so this is another thing about teaching, is that people tend to want to put the teacher on a pedestal, right? So
yeah.
Which is kind of cool at times, but at other times it's not so cool.
yeah, you don't want to be on the pedestal, do you?
Right. No, because it all comes crashing down eventually.
Yeah. Whoa. it's hard to balance.
I thought it was a god here, man.
Yeah.
Shit. So it's really there's all kinds of pitfalls that I've learned about in teaching, and one of them is just be as neutral as I can, and just creating a space for people to. Of course, I instruct, you know, things, you know, drumming traditions and stuff like that. But that's not the important thing. And there's a lot of, like I said, people are vulnerable and they go through a lot of emotional stuff. So it's my job to kind of, you know, watch that as well, to be part of that, be part of the emotional changes that people go through around drumming.
Yeah,
and around anything else.
Have you seen, how long have you been teaching drumming?
20 years. 20, okay. I just figured out the other, it was 21 years.
So in your 21 years of teaching drumming, you know, have you seen people, have you made a difference? Do you feel like you've seen someone, let's say, that came in as a hypochondriac crazy person or whatever? Do your courses and be drumming and stuff and get inspired
I've seen lives transformed. Not necessarily because of me, that's because of them. It's because of somebody's willingness to be vulnerable and to really, really step out where they wouldn't step out before, right? So it's not, like I said, it's not about me. It's about people. Well, all I do is create the space.
Yeah.
You know, and then people come and they go through whatever experiences they need to go through with it. But my job is to allow them to do that, you know, without judgment. And sometimes that's kind of a challenging thing to do, right?
Yeah, for yourself. Yeah.
So I've learned how to work with many levels of abilities over the years, and either as group abilities or with teaching a group that has different abilities in it. So what I do surgical teaching pretty much. I teach what seems to work, and then I let it go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to obsessing over somebody getting it or not getting it. So I gave that up.
I definitely noticed that. I witnessed that. You know, like I was in, how many classes I've been in? Three that you were in?
Yeah.
Since I've been here. And I've definitely seen the, you know, you'd show it and somebody would say, well, now what's that? You know, and, you know, you'd think twice about like showing it again. And sometimes you would and sometimes you wouldn't. And, you know, because the whole class needs to get it or whatever. And then, you know, you keep an eye on that person as time goes on.
Well, it's a balancing
kind of checking
act.
In.
It's a balancing act because you know, I want to serve everybody.
Yeah.
There, you know.
I understand.
The max, right?
Yeah.
So I'm in service.
Yeah.
I'm there to serve and to support.
Right.
And you too, as a teacher, you're there to serve and support. You're there to kind of help people evolve.
Yeah.
Emotionally, you know, and spiritually, and so you know. So that's how I learned. I learned a whole lot about human behavior, how it works, and what works and what doesn't, what things I do that were had diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, after 20 years, and I've had some pretty bad teachers. You know, I've had some bad teachers in my life, and
mm-hmm.
so, and really bad examples. As we were talking before, it's like,
yeah,
you know, we learn.
You get better by having
more,
better.
More profoundly by somebody by learning what not to do.
Yeah.
Because of what happened to us, right?
Yeah.
So, we all do that. You know, we're here to find out mostly who we're not.
That's a good one to end on. Do you want to end on that? Or
yeah, that's fine. Right.
So everybody's listening to this is not Bob Scarlett, and. And who's left over is. So thank you very much, Bob,
sure
you know, for everything that, you know, staying here with you and, you know, meeting all your accompanying family and friends here in Grass Valley and the area. So thank you. And I look forward to next year. Hopefully, you know, we'll come again.
Yeah. Let's make this an annual event.
Yeah, that'll be great, man.
So I have to say I love having you here, David. You've been a really wonderful companion to me. We've actually been married for 4 days.
It's a short marriage, man. We're gonna have to
get
divorced.